This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello again. November 2009. Of course, the nights are getting longer, and with the clocks going back at the end of October, in fact, it's darker earlier in the evening, so we have a lot of chance to view the heavens. And it's a very good month to do that, as we shall see. Just before I talk about the stars you can see and the planets, let me just mention the sun. If you bother to go to the night sky page on our Jodrell Bank website, you'll find I've got two images of the sun. One was taken by the STEREO spacecraft in the very end of September and shows a really quite massive prominence leaping above the sun's surface. And a SOHO spacecraft image taken on October the 26th does show quite a nice sunspot group. That's actually now moving almost to the edge of the limb, the right-hand side as we look at it, and appears to have got bigger. So I think the comment might be from that is maybe at last, after one of the longest solar minimas we've had for a while, the sun is actually waking up. Well, what about the evenings? As the sun sets, you can see that lovely region of sky with Cygnus, Lyra and Altair over on the western side of the sky. Due south after sunset is the square of Pegasus, and from there you can find the galaxy Andromeda, which is fairly high in the south, ideal for looking at the moment. Below Pegasus is the little circlet of Pisces, in fact below which lies Uranus, as we shall see, and then Cetus to the well. But that part of the sky really is not very bright, fairly empty. Up to the left of Pegasus and Andromeda, we come to another nice little region. You've got Perseus with its rather lovely variable star called Algol. And then to the right of that and up a bit, you have Cassiopeia. If you follow the line between Perseus and Cassiopeia with binoculars, you're looking at the plane of the Milky Way, and you should find a little fuzzy area where there are two beautiful clusters. It's called the Perseus Double Cluster, well worth observing either with binoculars or even better with a small telescope. And then if you look round towards the east, of course, Taurus the Bull is rising with those two lovely clusters, the Pleiades cluster higher up to the right, and below of which is the Hyades cluster that makes up the head of a bull. It's sort of a V-shape. Aldebaran, a very bright orangey-red star, is the eye of the bull. It is not part of the Hyades cluster. It's about halfway between us and the Hyades cluster, and is moving, in fact, southwards, whereas the stars in the Hyades cluster are moving as a group towards the east. So really a lovely skyscape after sunset. Of course, as the night goes through, Taurus rises, followed by Orion the Hunter, and we have some lovely things to see. Okay, well, what about the planets? After sunset, by far the most prominent planet is Jupiter. It's in Capricornus, and its magnitude is dropping very slightly as we go further away from it, or it goes further away from us. We're moving more quickly, perhaps, nearer the sun, so it's us moving away, and it drops from about -2.4 to -2.3. It still, however, has an angular size of 41 arc seconds, so with a small telescope you can see quite a lot of detail on the surface, providing, of course, the atmosphere is fairly steady. And for us in the Northern Hemisphere, we've been saying for a while now that sadly Jupiter is at the bottom part, in the bottom part of the ecliptic, and so never rises all that high above the southern horizon, no more than about 22 or 23 degrees. On the 23rd of the month, it's about 2 degrees and below to the left of a 40% illuminated moon just before first quarter. I'll come back to that because that's a chance too of finding Neptune. Well, Saturn can now be seen in the pre-dawn sky. It rises about 0330 UT at the beginning of November with a magnitude of +1.1. So that's about 3.5 hours before the sun. But by the end of November, it'll be seen almost due south in the pre-dawn sky, and that won't be at all bad to observe it, providing you don't mind getting up reasonably early. The ring system is still quite close to edge on. In fact, the tilt angle increases from 3 to 4 degrees during the month, so it will actually appear very, very thin. And because it's not reflecting much light, that's why Saturn isn't as bright as it often is. If you've got a small telescope, you'll easily see the brightest satellite, Titan, and perhaps one of 8 or 10 inches, you can actually see several more. So a little skyscape or detailscape to look at with a telescope. Well, Mercury, that actually passes behind the Sun on November the 5th, so fairly obviously it's going to be hidden in the Sun's glare for all of November. It'll pop out again, in fact, in December. Well, the other planet of real interest, of course, is the planet Mars. It's now becoming more prominent in the morning sky, rising, in fact, at about 9 or 10 o'clock. I observed it just the other night. It lies in the constellation of Cancer the Crab, and again, as we'll see, it starts the month passing through the Beehive cluster M44. So do please try and have a look at it with binoculars. Cancer the Crab isn't very bright, but you'll certainly see Mars and this lovely little Beehive cluster M44, sometimes called Prisipi. The magnitude is increasing. It gets to plus naught during the month, and the angular size slowly increases up to about 9.8 arc seconds, just under 10 arc seconds. And a nice rule of thumb is that when Mars has an angular size of 10 arc seconds, its magnitude is zero, just as it will be at the very end of November. It'll be seen due south, so obviously highest in the sky, about 56 degrees, which is pretty good, at about 4:30 UT at the end of the month. So if you've got a reasonable telescope, it doesn't have to be very big, by the end of the month you should begin to see some of the more prominent features, such as that rather V-shaped dark object called Syrtis Major. We're coming closer to Mars as the Earth is overtaking Mars on the inside track, and by about the end of January we have what is called opposition, which is when Mars is highest in the sky, due south at around midnight and nearest to us. So the next couple of months, as the Earth passes between Mars and the Sun, will be the best time for observing Mars for a couple of years. We'll look forward to it. Venus. Well, that's drawing ever closer to the Sun. You can see it low in the east, rising an hour and about hour and 30 minutes or so before sunrise, but that gets significantly less as the month progresses. I don't think you'll actually pick up Venus much beyond the middle of the month. In fact, the phase increases from 95 to 98% during the month, but of course we're not going to see it much beyond about 96% illuminated. The magnitude remains at about minus 3.9 during the month. So it's on the far side of the Sun and is going to be hidden behind the Sun for most of the next month or so. Okay, well, that's the planets. So what about some of the highlights of the month? It's actually a good month, as I said earlier. Perhaps the key highlight this month is going to be around November the 17th and 18th, which is when we have the Leonid meteor shower. And the great thing this year is that the moon is close to new moon, so its light is not going to prevent us seeing the fainter of the meteors. Every year, around November the 17th and 18th, the Earth passes close to the trails of debris left behind by a comet called Temple-Tuttle, and that gives us this annual Leonid meteor shower. Sometimes you get a really spectacular display, and it is just possible at around 2150 UT, or as we still call it in the UK, Greenwich Mean Time, on the night of the 17th, we might get a peak rate for a relatively short time exceeding well over 100 meteors per hour. So that's certainly something well worth looking out for. Again, the details you'll find on the night sky page. Something I haven't mentioned before lies in the constellation of Cetus the Whale, down and to the right of Taurus and to the left of Pisces. It's not that prominent. There aren't many interesting things within it, which is why I don't tend to mention it. It does, however, contain a very interesting variable star that was called Myra, meaning wonderful, by Johann Helvelius in 1662. It had actually been discovered in 1596 by David Fabricius. It was one of the very first variable stars to be discovered. Helvelius discovered that it had a 332-day cycle, during which time its brightness varied from about plus 9.3, you'd need binoculars to see it then, up to about plus 3. And on some occasions, it seems to get to plus 2. It did so, in fact, in February 2007. Well, the peak of brightness of Myra this year is on November the 18th, so it could well be worth looking out for. Probably the best time is around 11 p.m. in the mid-November, when it's fairly high in the south. So that's Myra, the wonderful star. When we don't have a moon in the sky, around the 16th of November, is quite a good time to find the planet Uranus, if you'd like to. It has a magnitude of +5.7, so just possibly visible with your unaided eye under dark sky conditions, but easily seen in binoculars. It lies just below the circlet of Pisces, which is itself below the square of Pegasus. There's a chart in the night sky pages to show you where to find it. I've mentioned M31, the Andromeda galaxy, several times. Pegasus is due south after dark in the evening. If you take the top left-hand star, go round to the left and up to the right a bit, two stars turn sharp right, pass one bright star, you should then, the same distance in the same direction, come across the galaxy M31. Just visible with your unaided eye if it's really dark, but easily seen in binoculars. Well worth finding if you haven't seen it already. The photons that fall upon your retina left Andromeda about 2.5 million years ago. On November the 23rd, Jupiter, Neptune, and a 23-day-old moon are very close together in the sky in the constellation of Capricornus. There's a map to show you where they are. The moon is just about 2 degrees up and to the right of Jupiter that evening. 4 degrees to the upper left of Jupiter is Neptune at 7.9th magnitude. So you'll need binoculars for that. It's not very bright, but it lies just to the left of a line of three stars, the upper of which, 42 Capricornus, is 5.1 magnitudes, below which are 44 and 45 Capricornus, each at about 6th magnitude. So if you find those and look just to the left of them, you'll easily spot Neptune. Of course, in the day or two before that, and the days after, when the moon isn't so close in the sky, you'll see Neptune more easily, because the background skylight will be less. And of course, it's so far away, it's not going to move significantly during the month. Still two to go. On the 8th of November, around midnight, the last quarter moon passes below the Beehive Cluster. Now Mars is passing through the Beehive Cluster at the very beginning of the month, so on the 8th it's actually over to the left. Again, a very nice little thing to look for. With binoculars you'll see the Moon, Mars, and you'll need them in particular to see the stars of the Beehive Cluster. Finally, this is a pretty toughie. November the 15th, there's a very thin waning crescent moon, just 2% illuminated. And that is going to be up and to the right of the planet Venus. Probably the last chance to see Venus this month. You're going to have a very good low eastern horizon. And it obviously has to be clear. But you don't often see the moon with such a thin crescent. Well worth looking out for on November the 15th. So there we go. Quite a few highlights. A good month to observe the sky. And let's just hope that on the 17th and 18th we have clear skies to observe the Leonid meteor showers. Well, now something for those of you that listen to the Jodcast from the Southern Hemisphere. Of course, as our nights get longer and darker, yours are getting lighter, so you don't have so much chance to see the sky in the next few months. If you look to the north just after sunset and it's got dark, you'll see the square of Pegasus in the north. Below that to the right, you could perhaps find Andromeda, although it won't be very high above the horizon. And then slowly sneaking over to the northwest is the Milky Way, with Deneb in Cygnus, the swan, just setting, above which you've got Aquila the eagle and the little constellation called Delphinus the dolphin. Now, what you do have, of course, is fairly high in the sky, the planet Jupiter, to observe far better than we can in our northern hemisphere. And, of course, Neptune, for us, we see it to the left, you will see it down to the right. But the little chart on the night sky page could still help you find it. And again, above the circlet of Pisces is the planet Uranus. So you could pick up three planets with binoculars, have a look at Andromeda as well. If you now, on the other hand, look to the south, you've got reasonably high in the south, the small Magellanic Cloud, with a little globular cluster, 47 Tucani, up to its right. Lower to the left is the large Magellanic Cloud, and at the bottom of that, with binoculars, you'll pick up the Tarantula Nebula, which is a lovely star-forming region. The Milky Way is stretching from the south, fairly low in the sky, but rising towards the southwest, where you have the constellation of Sagittarius. Let me just this month concentrate on one particular constellation, that of Crookes, the Southern Cross, which isn't very high above the southern sky, but you might well pick it up. It's not that big. You find it by finding the bright star Alpha Centauri, which is up to the right. There's a slightly less bright star, Beta Centauri, to the lower right of Alpha Centauri. They make up the pointers that point down to the left towards Crookes. The star Alpha Crucis, the brightest star in Crookes, is in fact a double star. Overall, the pair of stars with magnitudes of 1.33 and 1.73 make up the 12th effective brightest star in the sky. They're separated by 4 arc seconds, so a small telescope should be able to split them if conditions are reasonably good. They've got surface temperatures of around 27,000 Kelvin. They're highly luminous. In fact, the brightest of the pair is 25,000 times more luminous than our Sun. That's quite a star system. In fact, the brightest star is itself a double, and the two component stars orbit every 76 days, but they're so close you can't split them with a telescope. So in fact, it's a triple star system. Just below the left-hand star, Beta Crucis, is a rather lovely open cluster called the Jewel Box, so named by Sir John Herschel, who called it a gorgeous piece of fancy jewellery. It's about 7,500 light years away. It spans a 10 arc minute field, so telescope would be quite good to see it with, a volume of space about 20 light years across. And finally, below the Jewel Box cluster is a very dark region of sky. It's called the Coal Sack. It's actually the darkest section of the Milky Way. Whether it should be called an object, I'm not quite sure, but nevertheless, we give it a name. It's a cloud of gas, pear-shaped. It's about 7 degrees long by 5 degrees wide. And it's a dense region of dust and gas about 2,000 light years away from us that's hiding the light from more distant stars. It's the most prominent and conspicuous dark nebula along the plain of the Milky Way. And you can easily pick it out against the bright band of light. So that's another way to help you find Crookes, the Southern Cross. So let's hope it's high enough in the sky for you to see this month.